Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to this episode of New Books in History, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Michael Givan of Sacramento State University, but you can call me Mike. Today, I'll be talking with journalist Vincent Bevins, a native Californian. Bevins attended UC Berkeley before he began his career as an international correspondent. He worked for the Financial Times in London, covered Brazil and the Southern Cone for the Los Angeles Times, and then moved to Jakarta, where he reported on Southeast Asia for the Washington Post. He is currently speaking to us from Sao Paulo, Brazil, about his new book, The Jakarta Method, Washington's Anti-Communist Crusade and the Mass Murder Program that Shaped Our World, published by Public Affairs in 2020. And an excerpt of this has appeared in a recent issue of the New York Review of Books. Vincent Bevins, welcome to New Books in History.
Thank you so much for having me.
So it's really an honor for me to have you on the podcast for several reasons. The Jakarta Method, first off, is really an excellent book. Second, you're the first journalist I've had the opportunity of interviewing, and that's a fun treat. And even more importantly, your book deserves high praise for linking the overthrow of Sukarno, one of the great leaders of 1960s era third worldism, the rise of Suharto, one of the great examples of brutal and corrupt dictators, and the slaughter of 500,000 to 1 million Indonesians allegedly linked to the Indonesian Communist Party, known as the PKI. And you link that history to the Latin American dirty wars, including Brazil, Chile, Argentina, and Central America. This is a major achievement and something that very few scholars have been able to do. I will very, very, very humbly note that I recently published a very short piece for the World History Association's special volume on the history and legacy of 1968. And it was a piece about the destruction of the PKI. And one of the points I made towards the end was that the overthrow of Allende by Pinochet in Chile was called Operation Jakarta. And I wanted to get this global impact there. But you take this history of Indonesia 1965 much further and persuasively prove that it was an event of truly global significance. And I'm simply delighted to see this argument in print. Now, also, it's fun to have you on the podcast because on a personal note, as a teenage surfer in Honolulu in the early 1980s, who was interested in Indonesia because of surfing, it was my discovery of the history of Gestapo, the Sukarno, Suharto, and the mass murder of the PKI that led me to become a historian. While I've spent most of my career working on colonial Vietnam, I'm now returning to working on the legacy of 1965 and especially public memory. And I've been really fortunate that as I return to this history, there's this growing body of scholarly work of what some people call a political genocide, and what a 1968 CIA report called one of the worst mass murders of the 20th century. Now, your book, The Jakarta Method, is a much needed and very welcome globalization of this history. So I'm thrilled to see your book getting such high profile attention from the New York Review of Books all the way to the podcast Chop Out Trap House. Now, before we get into the book itself, could you please tell us a little bit about yourself and how you came to write The Jakarta Method?
Yeah. And thank you so much for that introduction. As you said, most of my professional career has been as a foreign correspondent for the mainstream English language media, primarily here in Brazil. I was here from 2010 to 2016, covering basically the implosion of, wasn't the intention, but I ended up covering the implosion of the Workers' Party and its social democratic project here, and the reemergence of a kind of a far right politics. Coincidentally, it just happened that my next gig was in Southeast Asia. I didn't go there looking to tell a story about U.S. empire or with any sort of agenda in mind. It was just the next gig. But when I got there to Jakarta in early 2017, I found that this story of the mass murder of approximately 1 million innocent civilians in 1965 was simply everywhere I looked, right? Like every story I was doing, it was just below the surface, if not right there staring you in the face. And when I would talk about this massacre to people back in the United States or back in the Western Hemisphere, I was really shocked at the extent to which people really didn't know about it and were very interested to hear more. And when I realized that there were these links to countries that I knew well and where I knew the languages, Brazil and Chile, I thought that this could be a way that I might be able to add to the important work that scholars had already done as a way of recasting this as a really global story that I thought that regular people certainly needed to hear. And it was, you know, luck or coincidence or just those sort of personal mistakes that ended up pointing me in this direction. But it came directly out of that work as a foreign correspondent. I came to the book sort of with the same approach that I had in my work as a foreign correspondent, trying to aim at a general population and trying to sum things up in a way that regular people could hopefully understand.
Yeah. So had you known much about Indonesia before you arrived?
Very little. One of the reasons, you know, I spoke to the Washington Post before, you know, in late 2016 about possible options, you know, possible routes for coverage around the world. There was, you know, Southern Europe, Northern Africa. There was West Africa. There was Southeast Asia. So I was drawn partially to Indonesia because it was such a big and dynamic, quote unquote, developing country. And I only vaguely knew about 1965. I had seen the film Act of Killing by Joshua Oppenheimer several years before, but I hadn't really appreciated its significance in the 20th century. It was... I kind of went there because I didn't know much about the region. I wanted to go somewhere where I could really learn a lot and dive into a new story.
Right. And it's, I mean, I'm sure you've encountered this with your conversations, but it's truly amazing how little the general American audience knows about Indonesia. You know, this is fourth largest country in the world, largest majority Muslim population in the world. And that it's so big.
Yeah.
You know, I teach Southeast Asia and I show my students a PowerPoint slide of the map of Indonesia laid out over a map of continental United States, and it's wider than the United States. And this is
right.
This is shocking to them.
And it's not just regular Americans that don't know this. I mean, it's like editors at the world's most famous publications. Like, people don't know what Indonesia is in the United States. They hear it and they go, oh, wait, Micronesia, Polynesia, what is this like? I'm like, no, this is the largest Muslim majority country in the world.
Yeah, a number of years ago, I was headed off to East Timor and I told a very senior colleague who was a classicist, a specialist in the Roman Empire, I was headed off to East Timor and he asked me if the Tamil Tigers were still a problem there.
Politely
explain the difference between East Timor and Sri Lanka.
People have very, very little idea of this. And I mean, not to be, you know, I avoid being conspiratorial, hopefully in the book, but one of the reasons I speculate that this is the case is because what happened there is so horrible and it so violently contradicts the American mainstream idea of what the Cold War was and how it was fought.
Yeah. And we'll get into this in a few minutes, but the sort of lack of attention to Indonesia on the global stage after Suharto comes to power is really in sharp contrast to what Sukarno's project was. But we'll get to that in a few minutes. So you the audience for this book, I think you mentioned, is really for a general readership.
Yeah, I think that was the only way that I could sort of responsibly try to tell the story. Like, I mean, as you know well, American and Indonesian and Australian and European academics have done heroic work sort of slowly piecing the story together. And they did the work in many ways of proving the bones of the story that I tell. But what I thought was not that did not exist was a way to sort of, you know, get your regular person back in the US or, you know, a teenager in Indonesia itself to understand the significance of this. So I really wanted to come at it in a way that was, you know, that honored what my skills were and what they were not, first of all. And for better or worse, that's what I know how to do, right? Like all my training is in taking a complex set of events and, you know, pre-existing literature and turning it into a shorter piece for a newspaper or magazine that people can read. So I came at it with the exact same skills that I had.
Yeah. And I think scholars will benefit from this book as well. I've been working on this stuff for years, but it was really eye-opening to see you globalize it and really make the connections around the world. And even the section on China, I thought was fantastic. So in terms of just a synthetic work, it is really a great contribution to the scholarship. So as I said, the Jakarta Method links Indonesia to Brazil, Chile, and other sort of hot battles of Cold War Latin America. But let's start with Indonesia, because it's really at the center of the story. So first off, tell us about Indonesia in the 1950s and the 1960s and why Sukarno, Indonesia's first president, really sort of Indonesia's founding father. Why was he such an important figure in Indonesia and internationally?
Yeah, so Indonesia, as probably your listeners will know, are the thousands of islands that make up the former Dutch colonies in Asia. And in the later decades of Dutch direct colonial rule, Sukarno, this very big thinking kind of prophet of anti-colonial Indonesian identity, comes up in a milieu in which the leftists and the Muslims and the anti-colonial and nationalists are all working together hand in hand against the Dutch, you know, the enemy of the white colonizers. It brings together elements that, you know, in a way that might be familiar to listeners. You know, when you have a big enemy, everyone comes together. And Sukarno very much comes up in this milieu and gives voice to sort of Indonesian identity. So when Indonesia is founded as a country, it is very much founded as an anti-imperialist, left-leaning, syncretistic, pluralistic nation. And it must be so. I mean, you could have never insisted on a single vision of Indonesian identity with so many islands and ethnicities and languages and religions.
And it's 17,000 islands. I joke with my students that it's at low tide, it's 18,000.
Exactly. Yeah.
Some 350 thereabouts, different languages, not dialects.
Yes.
So it's an incredibly diverse place.
As I put out in the book, the forging of this Indonesian identity through anti-colonial struggle, through finding the things that the country has in common, I mean, unity and diversity, as you know, the one of the founding slogans. This is a much more successful nation building than occurred in much of Southeast Asia. Other Southeast Asian nations still struggle to have a unifying language or identity, right? So this project that Sukarno led in the first years of the post-World War II period was at the center of what came to be known as the Third World Movement. And from 1945 to 1955, Sukarno oversaw a multi-party democracy, with the inclusion of the Indonesian Communist Party, the inclusion of Muslim parties, the inclusion of a wide range of political persuasions. But it is really in 1955 at the Bandung Conference, the Afro-Asian People's Conference organized in Indonesia, that he really steps onto the world stage as one of the founding members and one of the most eloquent proponents of something called the Third World Movement, which is to bring together all of the peoples of the post-colonial world, especially in Asia and Africa, and really take their rightful place alongside the first and second world, the first world being the former imperial nations in the white North Atlantic, and Japan, I think, usually should be included, and the second world, the Soviet-aligned communist nations. And this was despite the way that third world has taken on derogatory connotations in the decades since, largely because of the racism of people speaking the English language in that period, the Third World Project was a very optimistic, forward-thinking, inspiring, self-conscious movement to bring together the peoples of the formerly colonized world and to take the rightful place alongside white countries, alongside the other established powers. And to tell the story in this book, I interviewed lots of people that lived through the main events of the story. And sort of the most moving part of this process of interviewing them may have been hearing them talk about in the 40s and 50s what they thought the future was going to be like. You know, when I sat down with them, when you could see like behind their eyes, just a world opened up of what they expected the rest of the 20th century would be like as the Third World Movement took its rightful place in world history. And Sukarno was one of the prophets of this project.
Mm-hmm. And but it's a divided country. I mean, there's tensions. Could you talk about some of these tensions in Sukarno's role as sort of balancing these different forces?
Yes, exactly. So Sukarno comes up in the 20s and 30s, always sort of playing this role of mediator and syncretist, working with the left and the right. You know, in 1926, I think it is, he writes an article called Islam, Nationalism, and Marxism, claiming that there can be a unity. And he's always the guy that is friends with everybody and always plays forces off of each other and combines them to walk this very difficult line between all of the ways that a post-colonial nation could go. And in 1948, there is a clash between the relatively right-wing forces in the anti-colonial independence movement and the left-wing forces. There's something called the Madyun Affair, which sees the left wing of the Indian independence movement crushed and the leader of the Communist Party executed. After that, the Communist Party is reconstituted under new leadership, which is dedicated to nonviolent electoral participation in the young nation led by Sukarno. And then as the 50s go on, there are those in the country and in Washington as well, which are very alarmed by the fact that the Indian Communist Party does well with precisely this moderate, unarmed electoral approach.
Yeah, they're just to interrupt there, I mean, they're definitely not the Viet Minh at this point, right? They're
not
have a military wing. They're standing for election. Adit, the new leader, this young sort of vibrant character, was a peaceful strategy to power.
Yeah, and this had its deep roots in the Indonesian Communist Party itself. I mean, the Indonesian Communist Party was the first founded in Asia, and in the 20s, it was a two-stage party in the old Marxist parlance, which meant they always believed that you had to collaborate with bourgeois forces, construct capitalism, do capitalism for a long time, several decades, and then that would lead to communism. There was never socialism first. There was never any ideology which would have allowed them to say we should take up arms and grab the state and do this now. And that strategy back in the 20s was so successful that Mao was actually directed to copy it. It didn't work out in China, but this was a very old school approach to quote unquote revolution. And in the 50s, the United States notices these two things, right? So the United States, which has just overseen the quote-unquote successful overthrow of democracy in Iran in 1953 and then Guatemala in 1954, has previously seen Sukarno's anti-imperial left-leaning project as something that could be tolerated. But with the increasing success of the Communist Party and with the very vocal leadership of this Third World Movement, the CIA takes a very active role in Indonesia. They completely switch their position from one of tolerance to one of active confrontation.
Right. And so what was the opposition? I mean, Sukarno is this, you know, this plays the role of this sort of balancing act and the really cheesy cliche and, you know, card carrying Indonesian is sort of not supposed to say this anymore, but he was the puppet master, the Indonesian shadow puppets, the Wayang Kulit. But it's actually a pretty good metaphor. I mean, he's balancing the Communist Party against what forces on the right.
Yeah, so there are forces that are outside, and this becomes a bigger issue in the late 50s, but there are forces that are outside of Java and believe that their region should have more economic power over this new country. There are the divisions within Islam itself. There are the more syncretistic Javanese Muslims versus the more hardline Islamist or Islamist-ish forces, which really do not like the direction that Sukarno is taking the country. And then there's the military itself, which, you know, played a very strong role in the from 1945 to 1949, and always has a large role in the country itself. I mean, there is, and so the parliamentary democracy, as you rightly point out, is very unstable, right? So even before the actual CIA bombing campaign, which we'll get to in 1958, it's constant crisis within this young parliamentary democracy. It's very hard for him to maintain control. The cabinet is the ways that the cabinet is shifting really upsets people in the either in the quote unquote outer islands or right wing forces closer to Indonesia. It's very difficult to, I mean, in ways which you would expect of any young nation, but it is a very difficult balancing act that this quote unquote puppet master is sitting
above. We're not supposed to use that one, but
well, they use. I mean, it's like the thing where, you know, within they, you're also not supposed to say that the Javanese are inherently or culturally non-confrontational, but it's also something that everyone in Indonesia says about the Javanese if they're not Javanese. So it's hard to say whether it's a stereotype from outside or if it's a sort of
In the 50s and into the 60s, I mean, there's these ideological conflicts, but there's also some real-world material conflicts. Many of the leaders of the Islamic groups and also increasingly the army have an economic interest as landowners, running plantations, as former Dutch businesses are nationalized. Army generals get their fingers in there. And so any sort of labor activism or the campaign for land reform. And the PKI pushes forward the implementation of laws that are on the books for land reform and that which local figures are trying to resist. So that Sukarno's sort of balancing these two. Now, when most Americans think about Cold War Southeast Asia, they think about Vietnam, right? For obvious reasons. But you argue, and you've got some just really excellent quotes from political figures at the time, you argue that Indonesia was actually much more important to American policymakers at this time. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, I think it can't really be disputed that it was more important to them. I mean, in Bradley Simpson's book, Economists with Guns, he establishes pretty clearly that to the people that really mattered in the U.S. foreign policy establishment in the early 60s, it was widely understood that Indonesia was more important than Vietnam, and you can understand why. It's a much larger country. It has natural resources. It's playing this role in the global third world movement. It controls
the waterways between the Indian Ocean Basin and the South China Sea and onto the Pacific. I mean, just
exactly,
you know, old school geopolitical standpoint, it's important.
And so I think that's not really, something you can dispute that Washington, as an entity, symbolically thought it was more important. But I make the stronger claim, which is, you know, I think we could argue about that. The flip from Indonesia, Indonesia's flip from being a left-leaning anti-imperial sort of troublemaker for U.S. hegemony to a quiet, compliant partner of Washington is one of the most important victories for the West in the Cold War, if not the most important victory. And this is something that we could talk about, but certainly compared to Vietnam, where there was no victory at all. I mean, at best, you could say that the United States made it clear to its potential enemies that we're going to make it very difficult for you if you try to oppose U.S. hegemony. In Indonesia, this was a clear, unambiguous victory, and I'm sure we'll get to this later. This was such an ambiguous victory for other right-wing movements around the world and other potential allies of Washington that they realized that they could do something very similar in order to establish their own version of authoritarian capitalist systems.
I've found it useful to think about the end of the American war in Vietnam as sort of the United States cauterizing a communist wound. Like it's awful, it's still there, but it's burned and stopped. Really painful process, but it's stopped. This is, as you said, a complete flipping, but we'll get to that in a second. So as the United States, you know, recognizes that Indonesia is really this key domino in the domino theory, what do they do to influence Indonesia? There's a variety of strategies, some very serious and some tragic and violent. And there's one you include in the book that is just so patently absurd that we have to mention it.
Yeah, of course.
The
famous porno film. Yeah. So I think for a lot of people that find it surprising that the United States would end up participating in a mass murder program, it helps to understand that this was not sort of the first choice, right? There was a wide range of things that they tried first. And the first thing they tried was just to give money to a conservative Muslim party called Masyumi. They thought you know, as worked in many other countries around the world, if you pumped enough money into the safely moderate or conservative political group in that country, then the Communist Party would be stopped. But they were not stopped. And we know this, we know now from declassified files that the U.S. officials overseeing this, including Vice President Nixon at the time, knew very well that the reason the communists were winning more and more was because they were just doing a better job of outreach to the people. They weren't tricking anyone. They weren't using force. They knew that the communists were winning the elections fair and square, which was a big problem. The dates on the next couple events are not quite clear, but we know that at some point the CIA discussed the assassination of Sukarno and even came up with the person that would carry that out. They admitted this later in 1975. We know that they hired Bing Crosby in Los Angeles to produce what would be what they planned to present to the world as a sex tape, demonstrating that Sukarno had slept with a Russian KGB agent and was thus under the thumb of Moscow. So they wanted to produce some sort of, you know, the film would have shown enough of someone looking like Sukarno and someone looking like a Russian in a hotel room that they could claim under this, this is evidence that Sukarno is not only, you know, a bad Muslim and a traitor to the nation and, you know, morally repugnant, he is under the direct thumb of Moscow.
He got caught in a honeypot.
Yes, exactly. I mean, and to use the language that became very popular in 2017 and 2018, they wanted to say that the Moscow had compromat on him, right? Yeah. They could blackmail him into doing whatever they wanted. This was never released, not because they realized that this was a morally repugnant thing to do, to try to smear the reputation of the founding father of a young nation, but because it just didn't look good enough. They couldn't get the hair and makeup right.
The movie itself was bad, right?
Yeah, the movie. Yeah, we have a couple secondhand accounts of this to the point where I'm quite confident that it really happened, and what comes out of their accounts is that it was just not quite. They weren't sure it was going to work.
Yeah, and most of the Indonesians that I've actually talked to about this, both scholars and just and friends in Indonesia, both men and women, their take on it was that a leaked sex tape of Sukarno probably wouldn't have been detrimental to his political capital at the time.
No, exactly.
If anything, it might have helped. And there's a famous photograph of him and Marilyn Monroe.
Yeah.
And he is clearly checking her out.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And this played so well in Indonesia because here is the leader of the Third World Movement checking out, you know, flirting with the great American sex symbol. This is a way for Indonesians, particularly Indonesian men, and a lot of this is very gendered, to sort of, you know, put themselves into this. And it made Indonesians feel good about themselves that they were now being, they were now on a level with the white nations of the world.
Yeah, and sort of that bizarre sort of tidbit speaks to important points about the nature of the CIA, this new spy agency founded by this Protestant puritanical country in North America that was taking over control of the world for the first time ever, is that these guys that were in the CIA, they were sort of blue blood Northeast guys that came from a very specific cultural milieu and did not understand much of the world outside of like Britain and France. They projected their own ideas of morality and Christianity onto the rest of the world. And they often got really wrong what Indonesians would have thought about this. And I think it's important to recognize how weird the United States sort of is as a country. You know, it's American hegemony is so obvious now and it's been so natural for so long. But when I talk to Indonesians looking at the United States from Indonesia in the 50s and 60s, they recognized it as a weird place. It was the kind of, you know, this is a place where the white settlers were not expelled. They ended up destroying the entire native population. They clearly are a racist country. They clearly are very sort of believe in their own superiority. You know, this is something that comes natural now because everybody knows about, you know, we're both Americans, you know, everyone understands Americanness. But at the time, this is, you know, the CIA was weird and they didn't really get what Indonesia was about.
Yeah.
And then in 1958, as you know, the CIA ends up actively supporting a series of, they're called regional rebellions against the central government in Jakarta. But what this meant ultimately was that American pilots were dropping bombs on Indonesian islands. And these regional rebellions emerge out of those conflicts that we just discussed, the economic issues, the issues of the outer islands, parts of Sumatra being opposed to certain turns that the Jakarta government has taken. But in the end, American pilots are caught. One very specifically named Alan Pope is caught red-handed as he crash lands on the island of Ambon a few days after a bombing campaign killed Indonesian civilians. So the people on the Indonesian left, the people in Indonesia that had been claiming for years, hey, I think the United States is untrustworthy, I think they're trying to destroy our country, are all proved right. And if you look at the memoirs of Howard Jones, who's the ambassador that takes over as this bombing is carried out, he understands very clearly that the reason that Indonesia moves to the left afterwards is because of this sort of betrayal. And he even says, I understand why they would move away from us after that. We made it impossible for them to work with us. And so they moved closer to the Soviet Union, and they became more loudly anti-imperialist after that CIA invasion. It was, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it was the largest CIA operation ever up into that point. And it was based on the success in Guatemala. And unlike Guatemala and Iran, it was a total failure. And so the United States foreign policy establishment sort of with its tail between its legs regrouped and came up with a new strategy to engage with Indonesia.
Right. So what was this new policy rather than trying to, bomb and use PSYOPs to overthrow? Did they actually try to win someone over within Indonesia, correct?
Exactly. And this is something that Howard Jones, that ambassador, I mean, who knows how much credit you want to give him, because he, he claims credit for this, but he says that he's telling the people back in Washington that it just makes more sense to work with the Indonesian military. And this is exactly what happens. Thousands of officers are brought to Kansas to be trained by the U.S. military. They're paid very well. They, from all accounts, they have very nice lives out there. They have a lot of fun in Kansas. One of the people that I spent the most time interviewing for this book was out there as well. He was training as an economist at the University of Kansas, but he got to hang out with these military officers. And it was his understanding that they were being paid very well to be trained in sort of pro-American, anti-communist, military-led modernization theory. The idea that the goal was to form a country like the United States, because that was the best one, and the military had a big role to play. And as you pointed out, there was already quite substantial military control of the economy in Indonesia, not only because of the expulsion of the Dutch in 1957, and because of the huge role that they took in fighting the CIA and the regional rebellions in 1958, but then in Kansas, they learned, okay, the United States is our friends now. And the military really has a role to play in the post-colonial world, a much larger role than just being the military.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Until they start winning over this core group of officers. And one of the things that I recently interviewed John Russa, and one of the things that he really stressed in the interview and in his new book, Buried Histories, which is also on a podcast here on New Books. Check it out, listeners, was the structure of the Indonesian army. And they had these regional commands, and the country was divided up so that there was each of these provinces had army officers stationed there within the country, looking inward, not looking outward. And he said it was more than just sort of a shadow administration, but it was really sort of a parallel administration of military administration paralleling the civilians. And so he actually talks about it as a sort of a Gramscian strategy of building hegemony with Indonesia. And the army is looking inward and not looking outward to defend the borders. So the U.S. starts to fund and train, indoctrinate and forge personal relationships with the Indonesian officer corps. So what happens in 65, 66? I mean, this is a huge story, but quickly, what's the turning point that becomes what you call the Jakarta method?
Yeah. So two things happen, which cause the United States to abandon this tentative partnership with Sukarno. One is that JFK dies and LBJ does not want to spend the political capital on maintaining this alliance with Sukarno. And two, Sukarno picks a fight with Great Britain over the creation of Malaysia, which he correctly, but perhaps aggressively claims is being created in such a way to weaken the left in Southeast Asia. And the Western powers decide this is a step too far, and they remove that ambassador, Howard Jones, that has been working sort of to understand the deep nuances of Indonesia for a long time, and they bring in an ambassador that is well understood to be a regime change, a harbinger of a regime change. Now, we don't know exactly what they were doing behind the scenes for 1964 to 1965. This is still classified, and even though I called the CIA to ask them, they wouldn't tell me, unsurprisingly. But we know that the outcome that Western powers, especially the United States and Britain, wanted to see happen, and that they were agitating to create, was a clash between the unarmed Communist Party, now 25-30% of the country, depending on how you count it, and the armed right-wing military, knowing very well that when you have an unarmed civilian party clash with the U.S.-backed military, the U.S.-backed military wins. And under various mysterious circumstances, and perhaps John Roos spoke about this with you in the podcast, under very mysterious circumstances, and he offers one of the best theories, but it's an open case, this clash does happen in the early morning of October 1st, 1965. There's a something called the September 30th Movement, which attempts to kidnap seven generals in the early hours, ends up kidnapping six for reasons we don't understand. Those six generals end up dead. And the theories as to what this really is are numerous, and I don't try to solve that question because I really just don't have the skills, and I'm not sure the evidence exists to do so. What we know is that this is the clash that the U.S. wanted to happen. And when this clash happens, a general named Suharto immediately takes control of the country, ignoring direct orders from Sukarno to appoint a different leader of the armed forces. He immediately
jumps the hierarchy there. I mean, suddenly he's in charge.
Yeah, and this is an interesting thing I found in Howard Jones's memoirs as well, that Nasution had told Jones many, many times, in a way which is, I think, reminiscent of what happens in Chile in 1970. We can get to this later. He has told Jones many times, I will never be the leader. You know, I refuse to allow the Indonesian armed forces to lead a Latin American-style dictatorship in Indonesia. And even the embassy at first doesn't understand why Suharto is in charge, and it's not Nasution. Nasution is the general that's working very closely with Indonesia, or with the United States, for a very long time. President Sukarno, Suharto effectively ignores Sukarno when he wants to, and he takes power against the direct orders of the acting president, and immediately establishes control of the country, and then shuts down all media, which he does not control. And he begins to spread a very powerfully well-crafted propaganda story that claims that actually this was not an officer's revolt. Actually, what happened is this was an attempted communist coup, and that these six generals that ended up in the well, killed, were actually murdered by members of the Indonesian women's movement, the left, the feminist wing of the Indonesian left, and that they killed them in this horrifying Marxist tantric sex castration ritual. And this is the propaganda story that is used and spread throughout the country and used to justify the criminalization and the mass arrest and then ultimately mass murder of anybody that's on the Indonesian left.
Yep. And this then launches the systematic campaign led by the army, working with civilian militias that, starting in Aceh, moving through central Java into east Java and Bali, in the space of a year, kills 500,000, a million. We don't know. Sarwo Eddy right. at one point said 3.5 million, but
right.
he may have just been bragging. He was the officer who was sort of in strategic command. We really don't know. But the point is, when you're juggling hundreds of thousands of murderers, something truly horrifying happened.
Yeah, and I think yeah, go on.
No, and the PKI is instantly gone. What went from one of the largest parties in the country, what membership of what, 3 million?
Yeah, there was three million card carrying members that went through the sort of Leninist, they had to like really pledge allegiance, but there was 20 million more people that were in one of the affiliated organizations. And again, declassified files that we have from the UK indicate that maybe a third of the country were PKI voters, would have voted PKI in an election. And this was, it was the largest party outside of the Soviet Union and China. And immediately, in the immediate aftermath of Suharto's, the first half of his power grab, because for a long time he exists technically alongside Sukarno, although Sukarno's ignored as he sees fit. At the very beginning of this, the United States Embassy recognizes its opportunity to do what it's been trying to do for a decade, which is to crush the Indonesian left. And the CIA offers communications equipment to the Indonesian military. They authorize the distribution of weapons from the CIA station in Bangkok, but it turns out we don't know if that actually happened because it wasn't necessary. They came to the conclusion that they had everything they needed to get this done because, UR had 7 years of active collaboration with the most powerful military on earth. And a lot of I met a lot of the people that went into these jails and where they're from, which their friends never came out. And a lot of people that were taken in, arrested in this mass sweep in the weeks and months after October 1st, 1965, went in thinking like, oh, I'm just going to give an interview. I'm going to explain myself. I've been in this party my whole life. Like, we're part of the Indonesian Revolution. We're friends with the military.
It's a legal party. It's with no guerrilla movement. And why would it be a problem, right?
Exactly. I mean, you ended up in this party if you were from a certain village and you were one of the better students, or if you were into like the arts. LECRA, the culture organization, put on like the best, the most fun parties in a lot of the villages in Central and Eastern Java. And so like, it was possible to kill this many people. And this is a very horrifying thing to think about, but it was the precise reason that it was possible to kill this many people this quickly is because they had no idea that it could happen. Right.
Yeah.
If they were the kind of a party that the average American thinks about when they hear the word communist, it would have gone very differently. Right. They had no, I spoke to a couple of people that were active PKI members in Central Java that said, that they discussed with their friends, well, maybe should we like revolt or something? Is this something we should fight against? And they got no direction from the regional party apparatus to do anything like that. There was no theoretical or logistical basis for that kind of a resistance, right? And so maybe 2 million people go into jail. 1 million of them stay in concentration camps for, well into the 70s, precisely or only for their political beliefs. They did absolutely nothing wrong. And as you said, maybe 500,000, maybe a million, maybe 3 million were killed by, under the oversight of the Indonesian military, but often actually killed by some either civilian religious group or paramilitary group or someone that assisted in the actual violence.
Yeah, and there's a lot of mythology that develops around the killings. I forget the name of the journalist. John Hughes wrote this Indonesian Upheaval, and the portrait he creates, and you touch on this, is really sort of this Orientalist fantasy of these Malay people went
Amok. Oh, yeah, of course.
And that's just sort of in their soul. And
right.
And it was a savage bloodletting that's, the Western mind couldn't understand. I mean, really racist, Orientalist crap. But as scholars, John Russo, Jeffrey Robinson, Jeff Melvin, Annie Pullman, Vanessa Hargaves, they've been showing over the past couple of years that it really was a very cold, calculated program directed by the Indonesian officer corps. And the victims just aren't just rank and file PKI. I mean, there's all sorts of people that are not members of the PKI.
Right. And it really depends, where you are geographically and who's in charge of the local. And, Baskara Wardaya pointed this out to me very early when I was, in Jogja when I was working on this. He said, look, if it was a mass, spontaneous sort of purge, why did it move in very specific geographical patterns? Why did it target precisely the parts of the country where Sukarno had the strongest support? And why did it stop as soon as Sukarno was gone?
Yeah.
And of course, Jess Melvin sort of, amazingly found sort of some of the receipts of the extent to which the Indonesian military directed this and the two people that she points to most squarely as the early sort of activators of this plan both did study in Kansas. And again, like that story of the, oh, they run amok, you know, these wild people, it fits back in the exact same larger narrative that the sex tape does. You know, this is a country, a young, sort of ignorant and inherently racist country in North America. And it's very easy to tell itself like, oh, well, out there, you know, these things happen and we don't, you know, they're not like us. And so it was very easy for, you know, mainstream liberal publications to justify this in racist terms.
Yeah, absolutely. This is the same time that Westmoreland gave that infamous interview that's, I think, in the film Hearts and Minds, where he's talking about, oh, you know, oh, Westmoreland saying you got to understand the Asiatic views life differently. They're very fatalist, and he's sort of working in some sort of Orientalist stereotypes about Buddhism and.
Right, of course.
And just they value life differently, which I mean, anyway, but so yeah, this helps to sort of rationalize that. But again, it's not just PKI members, it's artists and importantly, unions. Unions are really crushed by this. The oil workers unions in Greater Sumatra, the sugar plantation unions in East Java. And you profile a young woman who moved from Central Java to Jakarta to work in the garment industry and just joined the SOBSI, the union, just because that's just what you did and didn't really think anything of it, and then winds up being arrested and there's horrifying imprisonment for years. So I mean, I can talk about this for hours and hours. I've been talking about this for years. But what you do in the book that was just so valuable for me, and I think for the field as a whole, is you globalize this. So the Jakarta Method takes this specifically to Latin America. So let's talk about Brazil. I'm no expert in Brazilian history, but in the book, you point out all these parallels between the Brazilian case and Indonesia. Could you talk about some of those before we start talking about Latin America as a whole?
Yeah, so I make the argument that probably 64 in Brazil and Indonesia 65 are the most consequential. You know, that long year is probably the most consequential year for the establishment, the effective establishment of authoritarian capitalism in the global south. And in Brazil, things are very different in the years before the U.S.-backed coup in 1964, because the Brazil, like the United States, is a settler colony with a large formerly enslaved, a population that was enslaved, being sort of by definition excluded from the political project. And there was a lot of similarities between Brazil and the United States in the 60s in the sense the president that was overthrown by the U.S. back to 1964 wanted to give the vote to everybody in a way which is probably very familiar to students of U.S. history in the 1960s. And the anti-communist legends that already existed in Brazil before the U.S. really started leading this Cold War charge were very sophisticated and very powerful in the Brazilian military. So in 1935, there was a small anti-fascist group that rose up with some communist support. It was crushed. And then the president at that time used this failed uprising to justify dictatorial control. Then the Brazilian military made up another fake communist uprising out of thin air called the Cohen Plan, which was anti-Semitic as well as anti-communist, to justify further dictatorial consolidation in the 1930s. And then they used this myth that claimed that this one real but small left-wing uprising had not organized itself in the normal manner of a soldiers' uprising, which happened all the time in early 20th century Brazilian history. The military and right-wing media claimed that actually what had happened is that they had snuck into the bedrooms of Brazilian generals in the middle of the night and stabbed them in their sleep. Right, and this is a very powerful and animating myth that is important in Brazilian politics, even before the Cold War starts. And so I don't think that necessarily this was a one for one, you know, they heard it and they copied the story, but I think there are really powerful resonances, I think, between what happened in 64 in Brazil and what happened in Indonesia in 1965. This idea that you use the story that actually there was a left-wing coup of the most devious type that wanted to kill you in your bed and stab you in your sleep. And that was what was going to justify the right-wing takeover.
Yeah, and it's in Suharto, I mean, in his propaganda campaign for the next 32 years of his rule, the so-called New Order, the image of generals being murdered in their pajamas is inescapable. Right. They make this 4.5-hour propaganda film. Have you actually sat through the whole thing?
I've seen the main bit. I couldn't. Oh. I should have made myself like learn it in and out, but it's so hard to watch.
Well, I watched the 3.5-hour version several times. First, I watched the 2-hour and 45-minute version, then the 3.5-hour version. Then someone clued me into the fact that the real edit was over 4 hours long.
Right.
But the image is this like 70s slasher horror film quality cinematic image of these generals and the one little girl being murdered and bloody in their sleep. And that it's just astounding how much that resonates with this case that you talk about in Brazil.
Yeah. And it's 1 year before, and all of these people. So all of these people the people responsible would have all studied at the same time in Kansas, right? So whether or not, you know, this was a copy, you know, there's a lot of people, I mean, you probably know this, you probably looked into this a lot more than I have, but I mean, speculation as I've heard is that this story that Suharto turns around and tells immediately seems so well crafted that one strong theory is that he must have come up with this far in advance, you know, to on the fly come up with this perfectly terrifying story of communist midnight treachery. I think a lot of people think is probably outside of Suharto's capabilities, but who knows? Maybe it was, maybe it was just, these were the kinds of anti-communist myths that were in the ether in the middle of the 20th century. Just in the United States, we have, you know, there's Reds Under the Bed kind of horrible mythology. And these resonances are interesting. But then when we move from 1965 to 1970, 71 in Chile, it becomes very clearly an explicit, and there's an explicit connection. The US-backed right-wing militaries in Chile and Brazil are using the word Jakarta to signify mass murder.
Yeah, yeah. So tell us about that. Like, how I mean, you give several amazing stories. The interview, students interviewing a general at one point, and then graffiti in Santiago. Like, how did they use the word Jakarta?
Yeah, Jakarta signified the mass murder of leftists. So, as the military dictatorship in Brazil got more, so from 1964 to 1968, the military dictatorship gets much more violent, much more dictatorial, it sounds silly to say, but they become much, much more of a hard right regime. And when Salvador Allende wins the election in Chile in 1970, this is not only unacceptable to the United States, this is also unacceptable to Brazil. And both US and Brazilian officials are collaborating with right-wing terrorists, essentially, and right-wing elements within the Indonesian military, or sorry, within the Chilean military, to make sure that Allende cannot take power or that he is overthrown when he is in power. And I think one thing that's very interesting, this is another resonance, and it's, you know, it's faint. Who knows how much this has to do with what happened in Indonesia. The first plan to stop Allende is a man named Rene Schneider, who's the head of the Chilean Armed Forces in 1970, is in a way similar to Nasution, somebody that is in his bones convinced that the military should never run the country. So Rene Schneider is what is called a constitutionalist in Chilean political terminology, which meant that he thought that the military should never run the country. It doesn't matter if Allende is a Marxist. Allende is the president. We're going to support him. The initial attempt, the first botched attempt to stop Allende from taking power, consists of a plan to kidnap Schneider and then blame the left. Now, this is botched because Schneider is killed, and it becomes clear that this was actually a right-wing terror attack. But who knows what would have happened if this would have worked, right? Maybe to this day, you know, there would be a monument in Chile to the, you know, to the victims of this left-wing coup, just as there is in Indonesia. Who knows?
Yeah.
But Allende takes over. He does take office despite the best intentions of the United States and Brazil. And in 1972, see the emergence.
And Allende is, of course, a radical Stalinist, far left. Who's Allende?
Yeah, Allende is somebody that believes in the democratic road to socialism, right? So Chile is different than Guatemala and different than Cuba. And Chileans themselves in 1970 considered themselves a different type of place. They considered, they're like, no, well, you know, this isn't rough and tumble. This isn't the rough and tumble of the Caribbean. We're sophisticated Chile and we don't do things like that. We'll be able to transition to socialism in a very calm and elegant way. And we're going to take La Via Chilena, which is the democratic, nonviolent path to socialism. And Allende believes that because of detente between Soviet Union and United States, that he has the space to do this. Now
I was being facetious early on.
No, of course,
you know,
of course,
but I don't want to destroy my career.
No, of course, of course.
And fairly moderate member of the left.
Absolutely. And well, we know now that this is precisely what upset and worried Richard Nixon, right? So the declassified information we have on Nixon from this time, largely because of the fact that he fell so spectacularly. We don't know as much about Kennedy and LBJ. His precise worry was that the democratic socialist, the possibility of a democratic socialist victory in Chile would encourage other people, right? The thing that he was worried about was that this would be an effective and victorious transition to socialism. And so during the Allende administration, the right-wing terror continues, and one of the major campaigns is to graffiti on the walls of Santiago, Jakarta is coming, and to send postcards to supporters of Allende and officials in the government saying Jakarta is coming, or just Jakarta. And in the Navy, there is discussion of something called Plan Jakarta. And anybody that's been paying attention to the Cold War at this time understands what this means. It means we're going to kill you like they killed them in Indonesia. And in Brazil, you have something, this was not a publicly discussed or perhaps even not even the official term for it, but in Brazil, you had something called Operação Jakarta, which was the plan to physically eliminate members of the Communist Party. And this threat in Chile that Jakarta is coming, we're going to kill you, is exactly what happens in 1973 when the CIA eventually succeeds in facilitating a coup to overthrow Allende and install Pinochet. They do kill the exact people that they've been threatening, and thousands of Chileans on the left are killed. And Brazil and Indonesia, or Brazil and Chile, come together in the years afterwards to set up a international mass murder network active across South America to eliminate opponents to the authoritarian capitalist project as they understand it.
And just as a little side note here, I was a Fulbright scholar in Yogyakarta in 2012, 2013, teaching at UGM, one of the top three universities in the country, and had these absolutely brilliant American studies graduate students. And I wound up teaching a class on American imperialism, which I didn't tell the State Department at the time.
Right.
But, you know, under the Obama years, that was fine, right? I screened the Jack Lemmon, Sissy Spacek film Missing, about the overthrow of Allende. And it was really the discussion we had with these Indonesian graduate students were very careful about not quite drawing the parallels, but saw the parallels there. It was really,
yeah,
really interesting teaching moment.
I actually got one email from somebody that said that they wrote an academic paper about this years ago about the strange similarities between the track two attempts to remove Schneider and what ended up actually working in Indonesia. I mean, I don't know how you're supposed to go. I mean, when I saw these resonances between Brazil and Indonesia, between Indonesia and Chile, I like didn't know, you know, what's the research project? How do you figure out if this could have been a transfer of sort of right-wing terror technology. I couldn't just prove that it was, and I couldn't figure out how to look into the possibility. But you do
talk about these international anti-communist organizations.
Oh, really, absolutely. Yes.
So, I mean, we're familiar with Comintern and ideas of international communist conspiracies and so forth. But you talk about these far-right groups that a few scholars have worked on. I think Scott and John Lee Anderson have a book on them. And there's other bits and pieces here and there. But can you talk about some of these anti-communist groups? I mean, both in Latin America, but also in Asia, and their global linkages?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Kyle Burke came out with a new book on this. Was this the sort of successor to the legacy of Inside the League, the John Lee Anderson book? But as you said, it's very well known that there was international communist conspiracy or cooperation across the world. But we, for some reason, failed to make the connection that the right-wing groups active in the Cold War had formal organizations they were a part of. They met up, they traded tips, they traded technologies of terror, they talked to each other about what worked and what didn't. And there was a couple official organizations that allowed them to do this. The first anti-communist organization is something called the Anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations, which is founded in 1946, yet largely composed of former Nazi sympathizers in Eastern Europe, right? And then you have the Asian People's Anti-Communist League, which is founded in 1954, bringing together South Korea, Taiwan, and the Philippines. And then you also have the Inter-American Confederation for the Defense of the Continents, a Mexican group, which facilitates the first linkages between Asia and Latin America. And so this is one of the ways that Brazilian and Indonesian anti-communists or Asian anti-communists could have met before 1965. And then eventually you get the founding of the World Anti-Communist League right after the violence ends in Indonesia, and the U.S. is participating in various ways throughout its lifetime. And it brings together sort of a rogues gallery of the far right in the 20th century, fascist sympathizers, death squads in Central America. Some Republican congressmen are there's varying levels of official U.S. involvement, and then sometimes, at certain points, it becomes an unsavory looking organization, and they back out. But there are all kinds of ways that far right movements in the late 20th century, in the second half of the 20th century, could have been trading tips and even personnel. And so two things emerge from this, which I think are quite interesting. John Russo pointed me in this direction to say, well, Vincent, look into the idea that 1965, 1966 in Indonesia was the first time that disappearances were ever used in Asia. And so I looked into this, and I could not find any evidence that this happened on the scale beforehand. And then, Greg Grandin, the great historian of the far right in Latin America, I asked him, when is the first time that disappearances happened in Latin America? Well, it's months later in parts of Central and South America that have officials that would have been intimately, U.S. officials that would have been intimately aware of what happened in Indonesia. So again, I can't prove this, but I think it's very suggestive. It's very possible that disappearance worked so well in Indonesia in 1965, 1966, that someone tells the death squads in Guatemala a few months later, oh, you should do this. And that's when it starts. And disappearances are now very famous in South America. And then another aspect of these international communist networks, whether or not this one probably not operating through the infrastructure of the U.S. foreign policy establishment, is that the person, we spent a lot of time, I worked with a great researcher down in Santiago, a student named Benjamin Concha, who spent a lot of time in the archives before I showed up to do the on-the-ground interviews, and we came to the conclusion, we're pretty confident, that the person that brought this metaphor, Jakarta, to the South American far right was a Croatian. So again, it's very possible. I don't have the proof, but it's very plausible this would have been somebody that was in Ustasha or would have been conversant with members of the anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations, this far-right group that worked with Nazi sympathizers in Eastern Europe. And I think that's one of the main points that I want to make with the book. And it's not a book that makes points, but I think that that's something that arises from taking this approach, is that I want to make clear that you have to view these right-wing coups or these right-wing death squads or this the strategies of anti-communist terror in the 20th century as a global phenomenon, right? These people that are ultimately victorious in shaping the post-colonial world in the 20th century work with each other. They learn from each other. They trade tips. They meet up at conferences. They trade personnel. And a lot of these big turning points in the Cold War make a lot more sense if you see them in the context of the other.
Yeah, absolutely. And the way you were able to connect this, I've said this a couple times already, but the way you're able to connect these is just was real eye-opening, and I think will be a real paradigm shift for the field. Could you say a few words on the impact of 65, 66 in Indonesia on communist movements? Soviet Union was sort of meh, but that you argue there was a serious impact in China and also in the jungles of eastern Cambodia.
Yeah, no, this is really, I think, underappreciated. And this is something that I was really surprised to find out about, but it makes so much sense, right? I mean, if you were on the left in 1965, of course you knew what the Indonesian Communist Party was. It was the largest unarmed Marxist party in human history, right? It was it was perhaps the most important democratic socialist party in human history, right? And although we completely forgot about it in the United States, they paid a lot of attention to the fact that overnight they were basically decimated by a armed right-wing military movement. And so from Chile to the Caribbean to Cambodia to China to the Philippines, a lot of people came to the conclusion that there was no unarmed path to socialism. You had to become self-defensive, tightly organized, violent, and ready for the inevitable rise of the, you know, imperialist right-wing terror. And the ways that we can trace this most specifically is that Pol Pot and the leaders of the Khmer Rouge, who at this time are still sort of operating in the jungles of Cambodia before the coup that overthrows Sihanouk, they come to the conclusion that they have to be armed and self-defensive. I interviewed, you know, you can, he's active, you know, he's still active politically and online all the time. I interviewed the founder of the Communist Party of the Philippines, Joe Masison, and he told me, oh, yes, this is precisely why I decided that the Communist Party of the Philippines had to be a clandestine guerrilla armed movement rather than a mass party. We learned from Indonesia that it was not possible to take the route that the PKI had taken. The Cultural Revolution starts 1 year after the massacre of the Indonesian Communist Party. Now, I do not claim that it started because of this, but the mythology, and not mythology is the wrong word because it was all true, the story of what happened to the Indonesian left formed a huge basis of the discourse of the Cultural Revolution. And a historian, Tawo Mozu, I'm probably pronouncing that wrong, Zhu, put out a book this year pointing to all those connections. And
mm-hmm. And
in Chile,
Mao Zedong and Aidit, the head of the PKI, had a personal relationship. They met several times. They knew each other.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
Aidit is slaughtered in Central Java in, I think, November 65.
Exactly. Right? And of course, the Indonesian military tells the world that he confessed to everything that they were claiming that he did right before he was killed. And the United States puts that message out as well, knowing very well that it's a lie. We know that they knew that it was a lie at the time. But yeah, Mao met with Aidit a few months before, and they have this conversation that is interpreted in different ways by different scholars. But what we know is that Zhou Enlai had told the Indonesian Communist Party in Sukarno previously that you had to form a people's militia. People's militia made you invincible. And, well, they ended up being very vincible, right? I don't have direct evidence of this, but it would make a lot of sense that China, the Chinese Communist Party, came to the conclusion that they had to be self-defensive and search everywhere for hidden bourgeois elements. And this is precisely the discourse of the Cultural Revolution, which starts just afterwards. And I only go into this a bit in the book, but there were Indonesians that were in Beijing studying in 1965. They stuck there. They were stuck there. One man, Sarmaji, he runs a sort of an unofficial library of Indonesian diaspora studies in Amsterdam. He's very old now. He lived through the Cultural Revolution and he understood very well the relationship to the Indonesian the fall of the PKI, and also in Latin America. So in Chile, the people on the Chilean left that I spoke to for this book, they said, oh yes, in 1965, there were heated debates on the left as to how to interpret this. And the Chilean Communist Party, still always loyal to Moscow, and Moscow's line towards Latin America at the time was basically, don't cause trouble, participate in bourgeois politics, help in the transition to capitalism. Will, you know, later there will be an opportunity. The Chilean Communist Party thought, okay, it's fine. Things are different here. And other other people on the Chilean left said, no. The lesson from 1965 in Indonesia is that we must be armed. And the MIR is the most famous group in Chile that takes this stance. Officially, they don't vote in 1970 because they don't officially believe in electoral politics, but they're all very excited. And a lot of them, they admit to me privately, they voted anyways for Allende. But this reverberates throughout the world. And it's not only the right globally that learns from 1965. The left comes to, not the left, as a model, but many left-wing movements around the world come to the conclusion that you have to be hierarchical, self-defensive, and even authoritarian. And I think this has to be, this moment needs to be reinserted into the history of the left. And I think it's very illuminating when we look at which left movements made it through the 20th century, right? Which ones ended up actually surviving the end of the Cold War, and for better or worse. And it's not a conclusion that a lot of the people in the book liked to admit, but they came to the conclusion that the parties that survived ended up being the ones that got sort of hardcore, that took a path that they didn't really want to take themselves, because they often believed in the softer and kinder path.
Yeah. So you've given us a lot of your time. We really appreciate it, but we need to start wrapping up now.
Sure.
One question I want to ask you is a little personal. In the book, you put yourself in there, and you have these moments of reflection on the role of the United States. So what did working on this topic mean for you? And what did it do for your vision of America?
Yeah, I mean, I'm only in the introduction and the conclusion, but I think that probably end up hanging over the all the middle bits too. It's a really good question, and to be like, I don't know, I'm not trying to like get out of it, but I still am trying to figure it out. What the lessons are, right? Like, what does it mean? And parts of this book are very psychologically difficult to go through. I mean, I made sure to really take my time. I'm sure John Russo would have told you something similar, but I really made sure to take my time to do these interviews in a way which was as frictionless and was least likely to be traumatic as possible. But it was just, even for me, just having to understand what it was. It shook my core quite violently to understand the ways in which, you know, and I ended up writing the book in Bali. And if you walk around Bali, you can look everywhere you look, you can see, oh, this is the consequence of what that was. I mean, why is it that these are tourist hotels rather than, you know, anything else? And why is it that, you know,
well, some of those tourist hotels are built on
directly on graveyards. And I interviewed
Adrian Vickers has a really great article in the Journal of Public History about where some of those sites are.
Yeah. And I interviewed one of the local sort of leader of a village leader in Seminyak, which is right, you know, like, as you know, the upscale beach resorts. And he's been finding bones for years and giving them a proper Hindu burial. And I don't know what the real lessons are, but I know that it made me a lot more, it made me reconsider what the nature of U.S. hegemony was. And you know, this was a nice thing that I got to pretend to be a historian for a couple of years. Even though I don't have that expertise or those skill set, but a really nice thing of being able to take this really big step back and look at a global story from, you know, with a really wide lens was to realize, like, oh, this era of American hegemony is not that long, and it's quite weird, right? Like, it's only been 70 years that a settler colony based in North America has basically been the most powerful country in history, and it didn't have to be exactly like this, and it probably won't be like this for much longer. So we should probably think very critically about where its power really, where this system really came from, and what possibilities that understanding might open up for whatever comes next.
If I can ask you another sort of personal question, and
sure.
A few years ago, I was fortunate enough to interview the filmmaker Joshua Oppenheimer, who made the act of killing in the Look of Silence. And if listeners have not seen those films, please, please. They're both just amazing films, both for their subject matter and as works of art. But in our conversation, he noted that he really can't go back to Indonesia, or he could go right back, but he'd never be able to leave. And many scholars, many academics of Indonesia know that they have to be very careful with what they write about 1965 if they intend to ever get a research visa again. And then, you know, for me, reading this book this past week, at a time when the president of the United States is talking about going after anti-fascists, which I would consider myself to be an anti-fascist.
Right.
Aren't we all? But the sort of these threats of violence and these various threats in social media, it's really quite terrifying and paranoia inducing. And this is also a time period where journalists around the world are really under threat. And so I applaud this bravery, but is there any sort of danger in this book? I mean, you mentioned a very chilling encounter with Jair Bolsonaro earlier in the book,
right?
I mean, you're dredging up some dark history that's linked to people that are currently in power in right. In Brasilia and in Jakarta.
Well, I definitely wrote this book knowing that maybe I wouldn't be able to go back to Indonesia ever, and luckily that's okay, you know. I don't have a career that needs to be based around that. I knew that it might be the case that the next time I try to go do a book talk involved. Well, that's the thing, is if you do, as you know, if you want to do a book talk about this kind of stuff in Indonesia, often you say that it's about something else. But
yeah. Don't say the quiet parts out loud.
Yeah. But, I mean, I was fully cognizant. I mean, I also, this is part of the reason I left. Once my final interviews were done, once the first draft was done in Bali and I got the last interviews from the Balinese survivors, I left the country and I knew maybe I can come back and that'll be okay. You know, I mean, hopefully I can. Hopefully I can give a talk at Taman Nam Lima in Bali, and hopefully it's not the case. But I was I was lucky enough to be able to throw caution to the wind because I don't need to work there again. I knew that it might be the case that I'll get stopped at the border. Now, the worst possibility is that I don't get stopped at the border and then I give the talk and then maybe an Islamist group shows up to physically attack some kind of which is why I'm going to think very hard before actually organizing any book event as to what risks I might be taking for myself or more importantly causing for the Indonesians that might help to organize it. Because one of the reasons I decided to put myself in the book a little bit is because one of these Islamist attacks affected me and my roommate personally in 2017. They had quite a banal conference to just discuss Indonesian history. And in downtown Jakarta, I went in the morning and then I left. And then that night they were attacked by anti-communist, Islamists that made my friends and my former roommate very, very scared for their lives. Yeah. So I'm aware of the risk, but luckily it's, if I can't go back, I can't go back.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, we do have a certain amount of boule or, white person privilege in Indonesia, but it's the Indonesians are much more vulnerable. So, as a historian, I was very appreciative that you acknowledged, the great work of some of my amazing colleagues, John Russo, Jeffrey Robinson, Bradley Simpson, Saskia Oringa, and others. Can you suggest to the listeners two other books that you really recommend related to this topic? Indonesia or global or Latin America?
I'm going to go for more than two. So yeah.
More than two. Okay.
Everyone you said read their books. Economist with Gun. I mean, Brad Simpson is the historian who really allowed me to do this. I mean, I relied on him very heavily personally. It was him that was his declassifications in 2017.
Yeah. He runs the National Indonesia section of the National Security Archive project. Online.
Exactly.
His book is Economist with Guns.
And Economist with Guns is the book that really establishes the influence of the United States on this mass murder. John Russo's new book, of course, and then of course the classic Pretext for Mass Murder, in which he presents his theory as to the September 30th movement. Saskia Wieringa's book on Garawani is really important. The, I mean, I think it's really underappreciated how this was made one of the world's largest and most significant feminist organizations, the Indonesian women's movement.
And how important the misogyny was to Suharto's rule. I mean, it's not just anti-PKI, it's anti-women's liberation in this transition.
Exactly.
Garawani to Wanita Dharma, this sort of housewife, leave it to beaver image of what the Indonesian woman is supposed to be. And that's in the National Monument.
This resonates really deeply with the anti-communism down here in South America too. I mean, communists were always associated with sexual. I mean, Bolsonaro does this. I mean, if I could open up my phone right now, I'm in several Bolsonarista WhatsApp groups where they just like send out their daily hate, right? They're the person they're supposed to attack that day, and there's always the association of the left and sort of sexual deviancy and women that get too big for their skirts, right? It's always, in a way that I'm sure will be familiar to everyone, especially women. It was easier to blame it on women, right?
Use the figure of the woman's body for political purposes. We see it from French Algeria to this,
And then in Brazil, the one book is Portuguese only, but Marcos Napolitano wrote a great book in 1964 about.
What's the title?
1964.
Okay. Marcos Napolitano.
But it's Portuguese only, so maybe that's not so helpful.
Was it not translated yet?
I don't think so, no. But I relied upon that a lot for the Brazilian side of the... this is great. They just translated Rodrigo Pato Sá Mota's book, On Guard Against the Red Menace, which is a book about Brazilian anti-communism from 1935 to 1965.
Okay. On Guard Against the Red Menace.
Yes.
Okay. And that's going on my list because
Translated.
Yeah. Again, the connections you made were just so eye opening for me, and I really, really appreciate that. So, finally, what are you working on now, and what can we hope to see from you next, and where can we see your journalism?
Yeah. So, you can follow me on Twitter. That's easy. I'm on there, Vincent VINNCENT. I really liked writing this book. I mean, I've been a newspaper correspondent for like 12 years now, but I would really like to write another one. Can't say too much, but I'm really looking at right now. This current moment is making me reflect a lot on the long tail of the protests in 2013 here in Brazil and how they ended up leading to the exact opposite of what they asked for. And it seems like a lot of the mass protests around the world in the 2010s led to the exact opposite of what they asked for. And so I'm thinking about trying to take a look at that. And if not, I'll be in probably back to London soon, covering the European Union's response to coronavirus and trying to get someone to give me a second book contract, basically.
Okay. Great. Well, I look forward to that second book. So Vincent Bevins, thank you so much for your time and for your excellent contribution to the field.
Thank you so much.
So this has been a conversation with Vincent Bevins about his new book, The Jakarta Method, Washington's Anti-Communist Crusade and the Mass Murder Program that Shaped Our World, published by Public Affairs in 2020. I'm Michael Givan of Sacramento State University, and this has been an episode of New Books in History, a channel on the New Books Network. Thank you for listening.